This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
6 months now since Nancy Guthrie was taken from her bed in Tucson. No arrest, no named suspect, a homicide classification, but nothing to show for it. Days ago, Savannah Guthrie posted the most targeted language she's ever used in a public plea. Words that suggest something is happening behind the scenes that the rest of us may not be seeing. Savannah posted a video days ago saying, "I know you have tried to do things the right way. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her." Why? Why this new video? That's where we're going to start this morning. We welcome your thoughts in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, wherever you're watching us. Comment away. We'll watch for those. We'll begin our conversation here. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent with us, along with, of course, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Jen, you have been the most comprehensive coverage person I know on the Nancy Guthrie case. What's your take? Why this new video from Savannah pleading, "I know you have tried to do things the right way. Help us find her. Tell us where to look for her." What's your take?
Well, I think for me, and I know a lot of my colleagues disagree. They still say these notes aren't real. They're not legitimate, meaning they're not from the abductor. That's what we mean by real.
Yeah.
I can't find one iota of information that doesn't show they're real. People like to say they're not real because they say, "Oh, it doesn't seem like what we've normally seen." Well, that's a pretty crappy reason to say they're not real. Look at the response by the FBI, and now look at exactly what you're pointing to. Another response that I believe is aided by the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit related to the language they're having her use, particularly in response to letter two. That is an apology letter, not really a ransom letter. They don't ask for money. And that's what I think this specific language talks to, because they're apologizing. And she's trying to say, "I get you. You tried to do things the right way. And you still have a chance to basically right this wrong."
Is this a response literally to like the note from almost 6 months ago now? Or do you think there's more notes being sent behind the scenes here that we're unaware of?
I don't think there's any more notes or any more contact beyond note number two, which came in on the 6th. The reason I think it's coming out now, though, Tony, which is a very important reason. Number one, 6 month mark, but she sent this before the 6 month mark, really. The other reason is because of that Reuters report that just tried to deep six those. The Bureau came back in their strongest of any retort we've ever seen written, saying, "No, we're still looking at some of those notes," and making that crystal clear. And then all of a sudden, on the heels of that, Savannah comes out, and I think they're trying to reinforce and trying to hopefully reach somebody who knows who Porch Guy is.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Jen, with the language Savannah used, matching the language of empathy and tone that especially that second letter struck. And I'm curious about this because I know other people are weighing in on this as well, because this kind of goes to the original theory that I've been working on, and that the abduction was plan B. And I know and that's why I'm curious about your thoughts on that, because the language used, and I know this is probably why Reuters, I don't want to speak for them, but others are saying that they're skeptical of the first two notes. Well, I think they're skeptical because they don't fit the mold of someone who's actually using her as the primary reason and way to get money. It was an afterthought, because what they were hopefully going to do in there went sideways, plan B, because this is not written by someone who does abduction or has done it before or really planned it out. What are your thoughts on that, seeing the full notes?
So I still have not waned in my conviction that this was a planned, targeted abduction for money. And I think that the reason the awkwardness of these notes, I'm very convinced, is they are AI driven and AI created, with particular prompts, probably from somebody who is not a native English speaker. So that's where we see perished and we see US dollars and we see the sentence structure of the time and the date that they want the money. And we see the R-E-C-E-I-V-E-D received spelled wrong on just one occasion because I gets confused. And so it went I-E. That's not what normal people do. People, human people, when are there any other kinds of people? When we make an error, we repetitively do it. We spell received wrong all the time. And so I truly believe these notes are AI generated and aided, and that's why they seem so awkward.
So my follow-up to that, you know, I'm curious, how do you think they were able to then create that second note? Because if you are, say you're using AI driven for the first note, which is very kind of matter of fact, specific and a little more tactical and strategic, less empathetic, how do you go then from that and demanding money on the first one? What do you think they were doing then if they're using AI to use empathy and a sympathetic approach on the second one where they're not asking for money? Just kind of seeing how you're thinking they thought through that.
I love this question, Robin, because when I was away this week teaching in between self-defense class and shooting classes, I was toying with exactly how you do that. And it all comes down to the prompt. Make an empathetic apology note for killing the person you kidnapped.
So, and I get that. So that's my question. What do you think prompted them to take that more empathetic approach versus the first one?
Oh, because they were in a crap load of trouble when they realized she died. They could not keep her alive. They mentioned that they think it is even a heart issue. It also tells me that they weren't close to her, close enough to know she had a serious heart situation, which you would never know that about Nancy watching her on the Today Show in November or other times. I mean, she looks like actually an 84-year-old that gets around pretty good. Right. So now she's dead. And now if and when you get caught, you already have, as you know, this is huge in we see it in criminal matters for sure, self-serving statements. You see them throw it out there. They'll send things to to the family members, basically apologizing for things in advance of possibly getting caught. So then you can say, listen, I meant to kidnap her. I certainly didn't want to kill her.
And one more follow-up, because I know, Tony, I'm hogging all your air.
You're fine.
So the first one, so basically what you're saying there, and I agree that they could be using that second letter for, you know, for mitigating if they're caught. Yeah. So basically what we're saying then is they gave up after the first letter. Is that typical that they'd give up or would they try not, wouldn't they try to get some sort of money for returning her body, for giving leads on how to get there? I mean, because it went from, if we're going on that theory, it went from 100 miles an hour to trying to get ransom for her to I completely gave up in the second letter. Is that normal, or what you'd expect?
Another great question. So initially when I was really looking at the wrench possibility, meaning a more organized and a criminal group that would have gotten a mope to do this, and I'm still, I'm a little bit there still, but if it's the more homegrown variety that ended up targeting her and then did this to her, I think they are terrified of getting caught, facing the death penalty. It's not worth it to them anymore. It's like, I'm out. My life is not worth it, and I'll go kidnap somebody else.
And you answered the question about, I was curious about what you thought about the wrench attack at this point, too. So you got that one in there, too. Thank you. I'm done.
If you opened up a door here with the idea that these notes were AI written, which they very well could be, We don't know that, but you're right. I mean, there's a lot of signs here that this was in some way machine created, if you will, to some degree. Not to say somebody's not behind it saying, communicate this, and then it wrote it. Here's a thought, and I'm wondering if it's been run down anywhere. Can we reach out to there's obviously a lot of AI companies out there, but there's quite a few that are commonly used, OpenAI, you know, ChatGPT, Grok, Claude. There's several within the U.S. that I'm wondering, Just as if someone makes a search inquiry into Google, Google registers that someone searched for that at some point in time, and that can be looked back of, look, some there is this amount of search history for this name or whatever at a certain time. I am wondering, and I don't know the answer to this question, if they were to reach out to one of these companies or all these companies going, look in your database of information and see where and when this specific text was created within your system, and let's figure out the IP behind it and who created it and where. Not just people, because I mean, tons of people are going to throw this into AI, but not that. Where was it? Where's the first instance of this pattern of these words, this note showing up in your system, and how who generated it? There's going to be a user behind it. There's going to be an IP behind it. It may lead to a VPN. It may lead absolutely nowhere. But I'm thinking that may be a loose end where somebody who's making this note is not necessarily thinking, gee, I better do this behind a VPN.
Well, I can't imagine that the Bureau hasn't looked into this. I really just can't. That they wouldn't have issues.
There's a lot of things I couldn't imagine not happening here. But so
you never
I'm
know
just, that's fan. Why I don't know. I'm just and throwing
you know,
it out there.
It up. I'm looking it up right now.
And we still anyway. Don't even have billboards. But nevertheless, yeah, absolutely, Tony. Can it be done? I think it can. It would be such a needle in the haystack where you really use this is after you have your perpetrator and then you look through their, you know, digital footprint. But this is the problem with that. We clearly are dealing with somebody that is using advanced cover-up methods, whether that's VPN, whether that's public internet, or whether that is using foreign, like Proton-type accounts. Yeah. There's all of this. And so this person, if they're savvy enough, I would be literally doing this at Starbucks, where it's Starbucks.
But oh, wow. Even, I mean, even so, I mean, you're going to get a user on that. You're going to get an IP of a device. I mean, again, it could be VPN, but I don't know. That seems to me like, you know, I get, you know, you're going to hide it when you're doing crypto and that sort of stuff and trying to get money. But writing the note, I don't know. I mean, that could be something that nobody thought to VPN because you're not necessarily, you know, hiding it as you're generating it. I don't know. I'm curious. Robin, what are you finding in your research
yep.
over there?
So it can be done. AI companies, OpenAI, ChatGPT, Anthropic, Claude, Google, Gemini, XAI/Grok, yeah. Microsoft, they all can do that. So practical limitations, retention windows matter, anonymous use is harder. Companies require a valid yeah. legal process. But with a subpoena, they actually can do that. So investigators believe the letter shows signs of AI generation. They can and likely would pursue warrants to major AI providers seeking prompts. And I made sure I made the request specific for a time period. So it can be done. And I would imagine, you know, because we're talking about, you know, sophistication as an individual, and I wholeheartedly agree with Jen. This guy is a mope, whether used by someone else or he himself. And I can't imagine there was a huge amount of subterfuge if AI was used to create those things. So it's a matter of where they created it from. But I think if they could narrow down, like, I would start with a 100-mile radius, and I'd start with that time period, and I'd plug it in and see what they came up with first, and then just keep expanding from there.
Are we still seeing a lot of miscommunication or not communication here between Nanos and Patel? Because you got Nanos this last week saying that Patel is misinformed and his public statements are hurting the case. I don't understand how that's even possible 6 months into this where we have no anything. And the person who said a lot of contradictory shit was not necessarily Kash Patel. It was Nanos. What do you see going on there in terms of two agencies cohesively working together to try and get somewhere on this?
Well, at the top level, they haven't even met.
Yeah.
So they have no communication. They have no interaction. They're not sharing text messages. This is clearly a situation where, and you know, it was kind of interesting because, and I couldn't believe Nanos did this. He said something to words to this effect. You know, well, Kash Patel's a busy guy. He's got a big agency to run like me. I've got, you know, 1,200 or so employees. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, he may not really understand how big the bureau is.
That's half the size of New York field office when I was there.
I know. That's what he was saying. He's like, he's an important guy. And then immediate shift, which I haven't been as hard on Nanos, I don't think, as some people have. I've really tried to give him some, you know, grace. And every time I say, okay, listen, you know, he's in charge, let's give him some grace. And then he releases the Bitcoin address. And then he says the FBI doesn't know what they're doing. And I'm like, oh gosh, Nanos, just stop.
You know, and I was talking to Tony and Todd before we started on this with my impression of Nanos when he came on again. And I've been the same, Jen, because, you know, for people in these positions, you want to give that grace because no one's perfect. But here's my major problem that keeps evolving more and more every time he speaks. And that is he has zero depth of field of this investigation. This is far and wide the most important investigation now in his department, if not ever in his entire career. And yet when he speaks, he does not speak with definitive language. He doesn't speak with definitive facts, details, or anything. It's very subjective, broad sweep. I mean, anytime you listen to him, it's like someone asks him a question, he's like, oh, wow, we're covering that case. I got to get on my boys to figure out what's going on. I mean, that's literally the way he comes across. A little too casual, a little too not detail knowledgeable. And I think that's what's eroding the trust on this is we're not hearing from anyone, bureau side, sheriff side, or anywhere that seems to have a definitive knowledge on what the hell is going on. I mean, we got more knowledge from watching Savannah and theorizing about at least the BAU's involved because it looks like there's some good effort put on in that letter. And that's it. Everything else is so subjective and it's very lacking of detail, I think.
How about this, you guys? How about the fact that he didn't even know Derek Colella wasn't sentenced?
Yep.
He didn't know his name.
That's what I'm talking about.
He literally threw out, he goes, that California boy, I think is how he said it. Seriously.
Yep.
He might have said fella, but I think he said that California boy found out that that people are going to be prosecuted if you send extortion letters or words to that effect. And then he said he got 10 years. I was thinking, he doesn't know his name. I mean, it's bad when a podcaster and a sleuth on the internet know more than the sheriff.
Yeah.
About the tentacles of this case. I am dumbfounded.
Everyone
as
does.
To how that could happen.
And that's what I like, and that's that depth of field thing. If you can't demonstrate depth of field as much as a podcaster, as much as us, I mean, Jen, you know this. Every time, not just prepping for Tony's show, I mean, it's an hour long. That's a lot of work to get depth of field of all the cases. But even when we're doing like a Fox or News Nation news hit for 4 to 6 minutes, it's hours and hours and hours of research that you're doing to make sure you have depth of field for anything that might come at you so you don't sound like an idiot like he does.
It's like he's not even trying. It's
yeah, exactly.
Like,
he's not even trying.
Oh, there's a mic. Okay, I'll go talk.
Like, I got this.
It's like just phoning in his job. Like what are we? Let me ask you this. Are we looking at this from an angle because this is a huge case, at least publicly, in terms of interest. But people go missing every day in the United States, and the FBI gets involved, and local jurisdictions get involved, and there's not this level of coverage to it. Had Nancy Guthrie not been Nancy Guthrie, had she just been, you know, Nancy, you know, Jones, and her daughter wasn't Savannah Guthrie, is this... would we be expecting the FBI director and the local sheriff to be having a conversation? Are we expecting too much out of this? Not that they couldn't be doing more, but are we putting too high of a bar on this? This is going to get all of this attention and this is going to get all of these resources. Nancy's another person in the country of a lot of missing people. Are we putting too much weight on the fact that of the attention this case is getting just because it's a famous person, if you will?
Well, I mean, you just made the point right there. The horse done left the bar.
Yeah.
It's already to this level that you had on day very shortly after. I can't remember the exact day. The president of the United States addressing the Nancy Guthrie case after he was briefed. You have Kash Patel that's come out on 3 different shows that I've watched,
yeah,
where he talks about his knowledge of the case, which is, I agree with you, it's unusual, but it's, that's where we're at, and he's involved. And so you would never expect Kash Patel to be in the weeds like he is on any of these cases. We've never seen that before. It started with Comey. It did start with Comey, I'll tell you that, getting in the weeds on cases. But Sheriff Nanos, he is the sheriff. It's on him to know all these details. And if he doesn't, put your detective up there. And did you hear there was a detective change?
No.
There's another
one. I need to put that out.
Yeah. And so I get it. And we talk about this a lot on the show with the cases that get attention and the cases that don't and the families that feel like they've been left behind and those that don't. And I get all that. But the sheriff and us don't choose what that grabs the interest of the American people. And when it does, that's their job. Because part of what you do as a leader is you maintain the trust and confidence of your population, of the people at large and the nation at large, that we can keep you safe, that justice is going to be served, and the public chooses what case they want to pay attention to, and your job is to demonstrate that you can do that, not just for this case, but that means we could do it for all the cases, and that's what he's failing on, I think, in my estimation.
Yeah. It is, and he got off on the wrong foot when he decided to go to a basketball game, like on day two. No one does that when the bell rings. Did you... that is the term my boss always used. Guys, the bell's rung. That means drop everything, and you're going to spend all of your time on this until I unring the bell. I don't know if that was a phrase you heard, or it's because I had a Hooverite supervisor, Dick Ludwig. But man, when the bell rings, you don't get to even go to a kid's birthday party. You're stuck working on that case until the bell unrings.
Yeah. And that does happen. And we've seen it. And I'm sorry, Tony. And we've seen it when Koberger's case, when they first made the first statements there, they're stumbling on themselves. And down in Nolan Wells's case, the sheriff, same thing, too quick to say it wasn't foul play is being ruled out. And what did both of those people do after they backtracked, they shut up, they readjusted, they reengaged, they got someone else in there, they adjusted, they learned from their mistakes, and they're marching forward to do what? Maintain a trust and confidence of the people around them, to support them, to get the leads in, and Nanos is doubling down on stupid. I mean, we're talking about, isn't he getting a loving critic in his life weighing in on him, you know, saying, but it doesn't matter. If you're not taking the information in, anyone, you know, the world could be telling you what to do, but if you think you got it because you're smarter than everyone else, you're not going to adjust.
Do you think Nanos is really the type of human being who has loving critics in his life? Who allows loving critics in his life? I mean, he seems to be more like, you criticize me, you're just not going to be part of my conversation.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. So, exactly. It's like, I think it's kind of, he shuts out, and this is my conjecture, shuts out anybody. He seems like he's surprised he's the sheriff every time I see him. It's like, oh, I'm the sheriff today. I better, my words matter. I'm not used to that. Like, literally the shit he said. Like, yeah, I mean, that's why it matters who you vote for. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to have our conversation.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.